Hey listeners, welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. Today, we have a varied conversation with our guest, Hallie Stern, a Hollywood actress turned expert on the human side of global cyber conflict. We discuss how Hollywood actors game the social media algorithms. We understand how invasive surveillance targeting causes the rise of mis- and disinformation. And we learn the inner workings on how to go viral on social media. We have a huge announcement towards the beginning of the episode, so be sure to stick around. As a reminder, the views stated in this episode are not affiliated with any organization and only represent the views of the individuals. We hope you enjoy the show. Welcome, Hallie, to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell me about yourself.
So I actually started my career in entertainment and worked between LA and New York and kind of came up while everything was moving online. So like sketch comedy was a big, was something I had my hand in a lot of, like in my early 20s. And as like the Hollywood infrastructure was moving online, I got pretty good at messing with the algorithm to like propagate my story, like of how I wanted to present myself at time to make it seem like I was doing more than I was, which now in hindsight is super unethical and shady. But at the time I was experimenting with like DDoSing my own IMDb page to raise my star meter or like targeting specific audiences so I could get in front of like different producers with the stuff that I was producing. So,
Did it work?
Yeah, it did. It's a little different now, but I somehow got way better at that than like actually the craft of like performing, and started getting hired by other people to like manage their social media or push out press releases or do more in the like digital marketing space at the time, which was like kind of brand new. And when I decided to shift from like performing arts to like, I don't know, I had my like year of, I don't know what I'm doing. So I traveled the world for a year, like as a digital nomad.
Everyone has that year.
Yeah. My eat, pray, love year.
It's one of those, startup, one of those, you know, just, you work for a little bit, get burnt out, got to travel the world, find yourself, and then you'll figure out what you can do next. I'm still figuring it out though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're all still figuring it out. Yeah. I mean, I'd been working at a talent agency and like was not loving it and was not loving Hollywood at the time. I had wanted to be a showrunner and like create my own TV productions and like push it out. And now I was using the new media contract.
There's this crazy new like place called Trust in Tech, which is another show. Have you tried working for that show?
Oh, well, now that you say it, I think I might be soon coming to join the show. Being a showrunner.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. Weird, right?
Weird how that worked.
So I will be listening, coming on to help produce and co-host with the Trust in Tech podcast, which I'm very excited about because it merges two of my favorite things, tech and putting a show together and talking to cool people.
No DDoSing for publicity this time, though.
No DDoSing for publicity. I've learned my lesson. But yeah, so I did this program called Nomad MBA in Africa, which was like digital entrepreneurship across borders, how local communities were coming together to use technology to solve issues of hunger and homelessness, and like how they could, instead of relying on like going after finding a job, create jobs themselves. So like these startup economies happening in Africa. And that was a really, really interesting trip. I continued on to Indonesia in Bali, because where else do you go when you're a digital nomad? And I got invited to, from there, volunteer at this refugee camp in Greece, where I was teaching like tech skills, like basic computer skills to my students. And while I was there, I noticed that while my students were coming from really horrific backgrounds and situations, the final catalyst for them coming over was stories and images that they were seeing online that were propagated to them through specific algorithms based on the data they were putting out that then got targeted to them the same way that I was targeting people to view my stories when I was in LA.
So what stories were being propagated there?
So it was really interesting. So it would be like a story from the West of someone living a certain kind of life, or there would be something trending within the community, and they would really accept it at face value as, oh, if I move over here, this is what my life can look like. And of course, they would come over to Greece and be put in like a retention for 30 days. And it wouldn't be anything like they thought it was. And then they'd be able to move about the island 30 days in, and they would then perpetuate it by taking pictures and saying, look, I've made it. I'm in Europe. And that would go back to their families and friends who would say, look, they made it. I can too. And so it was just this cycle of story sharing that wasn't necessarily showing all of what was going on. The conditions at the camp were not good. And so the story, I mean, they were seeing inspiring stories, which is beautiful. And they were sharing inspiring stories, which was beautiful. But because of the way that the data environment works to push those stories within specific populations, there were definitely some harms coming from it because they weren't getting the full picture.
Yeah, that reminds me of two things. One is there's this Hollywood angle, because Hollywood basically does the same thing. I guess people that come here have this like Hollywood look at what their life is going to be and get a straight reality check when that happens. So that's one thing. And the other thing is it's almost like glorifying your own life is producing a misinformation harm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, true almost always for social media, generally speaking. So. That's good to riff on. That's good to think about.
Yeah. What they won't know is like they'll see a beautiful woman laying by a pool, or a man in a bar, or a group of friends, you know, together. And what they, most people, and we all know this, but we don't equate it with the information we receive. It's like someone took 50 pictures in that one angle to get like just the right look to post that right thing with the right filter. Right. And I had a discussion actually earlier today with a UN group, and we were discussing like it's based on the data, right? It's based on our data output and what's being collected on us specifically. So like you could be inoculated against disinformation from head to toe, know what's real and what isn't, and you're still seeing information, and you're still only going to see the information that's specifically propagated to you based on the data that's been collected that cohorts you into a specific group. So I usually say by the time we're seeing a story, we're already at the end of the funnel. What is knowable about you, and what is the information that you're giving off that is allowing that specific story to propagate within your network? And that's the question I asked myself when I was there, hence going and getting my master's degree at NYU in global security, conflict, and cybercrime, and focusing on the human side of cyber conflict. How and why people respond offline to what they see online based on their data, and how that impacts the world around them, which is like, I guess, kind of what I did in Hollywood, because, you know, getting people to respond to stories is kind of the name of the game, right? So yeah, I'll get a lot of pushback. Hallie, you've changed so much. You're doing something so different. I'm like, nope, I'm not. I'm just looking at it now at a geopolitical level and how it's impacting people globally.
Is there a lot of talent from Hollywood that could come to these integrity environments?
Yes and no. I think it's important to understand like the ad tech infrastructure and how cross-platform algorithms work. So people who understand that landscape, absolutely, right? We're often told Facebook's the problem, or Google's the problem, or TikTok's the problem. And like, yeah, maybe, but the problem isn't necessarily these singular platforms. It's how connected these platforms are to literally everyone and everything else. You can't have a presence or run a company or sell a product unless you are in some way plugged into any number of these environments. And so it's the collective data that's collected across platforms, not just one or two, that really creates the issue. And I think Hollywood people who get the ecosystem, because, you know, it Hollywood promotes like a freelance economy, right? Like you are your business. How do you promote yourself? And you have to find those loopholes, as like, again, shady and kind of vain as it sounds. And of course, people in DC or people who have objectives for the greater good are like, oh, that's really vain. And it is. It's super vain and terrible because you're promoting yourself through social media. But if you understand how that works and how information propagates using those tools, then you can understand how it can be weaponized and you can understand how to mitigate harm or push out other messages or counter that harm. So yeah, it's a loaded question. Anyone working in Hollywood who's in the digital media environment, I think absolutely should and could have their hand in the trust and safety conversation.
How did you preserve that freelancing aspect from Hollywood and bring it to the trust and safety environment?
Yeah, so I've always kind of done it. I mean, my options at the time were work as a waitress, which I was not good at. I was the worst waitress. Or find a way to make my own money. And it really just started with managing social media. But from there, you know, I would dig into it and find like algorithmic loopholes because patterns are like my thing.
What do you mean by algorithmic loopholes? Let me dig a bit.
I'll go to a research project I did a couple years ago. Like, so if you're an influencer in Hollywood, you often are a member of an influencer boost group on Telegram, which means that you'll join a pod within a cohort, like your quote type, and you'll like 30 links to Instagram posts, and then you'll drop your Instagram link, and then 30 other people will like your posts. And this can be automated or this can be done by hand. If you pay for it, it'll do it for you. And what it does is it creates an environment in Instagram where it registers as a unique visitor to your page and therefore pushes you to the top of the algorithm for not just your followers, but followers of your followers. So within 2 and 3 degrees of your network. That can also be used for harm. So I noticed, as you know, when I was back in the day, definitely used boost groups, kind of ashamed. But a lot of people do it. But I noticed that there were links being dropped into the boost group that didn't necessarily go anywhere or would go to a page and then relink somewhere else. And I found that those links were leading to adware being downloaded to Chrome browsers to be able to, I don't want to say spy, but collect data on like your what other sites you were visiting, what you were typing into your computer without you realizing it, right? So it went from being a story in an influencer environment to a cybersecurity issue. And so there's a really fine line between the two if we're not paying attention to how the algorithms work. So when I say algorithmic loopholes, I mean, how is the like ad tech economy, influence economy, data economy being used to harm? How are these commercial tools being weaponized? And that is one, I guess, loophole in that. Another one was back me DDoSing my IMDb page. I mean, you know, like I get...
That's pretty sick.
It feels like a different lifetime ago. Yeah, I wasn't exactly the most secure person, but it worked. I mean, I got my star meter to go up and I got people's attention. Whether it was good or bad doesn't necessarily matter because it worked, right? Now, there's, you know, obviously some stuff that I've done that I've been like, oh man, like I was kind of an idiot back then, but I'm still glad that I learned through doing because now I understand how to look for algorithmic loopholes. I understand how ad tech is weaponized. I understand how algorithms are weaponized to propagate stories to specific audiences. And like I said, by the time you're seeing a story, you're at the end of the funnel. There's so much more that goes into it. It's more than saying, oh, this person saw the story and that's bad. We must take it down. It becomes a game of whack-a-mole. It's, hey, this person is exhibiting these patterns throughout their digital environment, which leads them, like, if they like this, they might like this, right? And that data is collected from every piece of technology you use, from your credit card, which absolutely sells your financial, like, transaction data, to the telemetrics on your phone, to who you're hanging out with, who you're in proximity to. So there's so many factors that go into story propagation before you even see the story that I think is so underconsidered. So, I mean, I will fight till I turn blue to say that disinformation is a cybersecurity and a data security issue. Yes, there's the cognitive side of it. Yes, people need to understand what they're seeing. But I think if we had a better understanding in general of the information ecosystem, we'd be able to make a lot more informed decisions about what to do about it.
So let's dig a bit deeper on that. So you're saying that it's more about data privacy and cybersecurity than it is about user-side mitigations or content moderation or user education or actor recidivism. It's more looking at the signals that advertisers or any other people or other actors can use to manipulate the users. So can you lay that framework out, and then we'll go more into it?
Yeah. So I just want to preface by saying, I think that the human side, the outreach part, the content moderation, the understanding how and why people are absorbing stories the way that they are is extremely crucial. The education is crucial. It needs to exist, right? This is not a one size fits all solution. I'm saying, though, that the signals that we're giving off play a major part in how the information we're seeing gets propagated. So instead of bringing issues of like freedom of speech into play, we can be bringing issues of how is data being collected, and is that ethical for, is it ethical to market to this group of people in this way, knowing that these algorithms can be used to push this information to this cohort of people based on the sensor data that has been collected on them. And so then it shifts the conversation.
Can we get an concrete example on that?
So like, you know how like a lot of people think their tech is listening to them, right? Like,
sure.
Right. And yes, there have been cases where like Uber and other platforms have listened, right? But the reality is they're not. What they're doing is worse. They're inferring us. And so an example that I've given before is, say you've used your credit card to book a ticket to go see your family in another state. That credit card transaction is used to validate that you are who you say you are. You booked it through your phone, you get on the plane, you go to see your family member. Your family member is getting ready for you to come see them. They've made up maybe the guest bedroom, they've bought a dinner that they're making for you. And on the way, on their way to like, I don't know, pick up something from the grocery store, their car breaks down. And it's really annoying, and they have to go get like a tire fixed or whatever they have to do with their car that's broken down, and finally get it fixed. They come, they pick you up at the airport, and oh my God, you'll never believe what happened today. My car broke down. And then you start to see ads about cars, right? And you think, oh my God, it was listening to my conversation about the car breaking down. Well, no, what happened was your family member was at a car place pinging their cell network directly to where that car place was. They probably made a transaction at that car place. That transaction is now associated with you coming there because you are within two degrees of their direct network. And when you arrive at the airport, your car, your phone is in direct proximity to that person who was just at a car dealership. So you were likely going to discuss a car issue, knowing that that's where this person is coming from. So it's inferring your patterns. It's inferring what you might talk about. I had this when I was in Montreal a couple years ago. I was going on a hike and I started getting ads for like bunion stuff. And I was like, oh my God, does it know something I don't? But I had actually been shoe shopping for like sneakers earlier that day. And I was with someone who had a bunion problem. And so I was getting advertisements because of the proximity I was with her and the sensor technology that was being collected on me. So, you know, it's not listening to you. What's doing is worse. It's inferring your patterns. So understanding the data that we're giving off, the signals that we're giving off across all of the applications that we use, across all of the technology that we use, how do we deal with that? Because if we deal with that, I truly believe we can start to deal with the issue of disinformation.
So just as a theoretical example, let's say that you are not giving off any information. TikTok doesn't have any information on you from in-app itself. It doesn't have any of the data broker information. Do you think misinformation plummets down from that?
Not necessarily, because even not having a data footprint is a footprint, right? Like if you're not on TikTok, but you're on these other applications, like your email address is still logged in to other things that you're using. You are still using your credit card. You are still paying your bills online. You still have a data pattern, even if it's not directly on TikTok. Your email address, your phone number is associated with all of these other applications and transactions and movements that validate A, that you're not a bot, which is a good move, but B, you know, kind of tell different ad tech algorithms who you're with and what you're doing. So it's not necessarily a singular, like, it's a TikTok issue. I'm not on TikTok, so it doesn't matter. I had a conversation with someone last night who was like, well, I don't have social media, so it doesn't matter. I'm like, okay, so you don't watch movies at home. You don't have an Amazon account. You don't play music. You don't drive anywhere. You don't call people on the phone, because this is all collected, again, within, I mean, it's a social network for a reason, right? What happens online is a direct mirror of our offline lives. So it's going to be within your direct network and proximity and connectedness to other people and where you're pinging from. If I'm in DC and I'm walking by a bakery and I later get an advertisement for that bakery, well, yeah, because they were targeting somebody who was in this area at this time, you know, whose self network was pinging there. So, I mean, there's so many different sensors and so many ways to go about it. And I think it takes such a hybrid approach to deal with the issue. Like, on the other side of this, it's not just a signals issue. It's not just an ad tech issue. It is an education issue in the sense that nobody really understands how the data environment works. And if you don't understand how the data environment works, or how the cyber digital information environment as a whole works, how can you possibly make policies to mitigate harm?
So then how does that connect to misinformation? How does all this data collection, for example, like, you get an advertisement for a car, how does that translate to misinformation?
Right. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the car place is going to push out disinformation at you. What it does mean, though, is that there is a data profile on you based on specific data points you give off. So like, Google has their Google verticals that you can look at. And that's like their 2,500, like where they're organizing you into within 2 and 3 degrees of your network. And they use it for backend developers. But it's
also essentially, they have a taxonomy of, they'll throw you into one of 2,500 buckets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, you'll be in multiple of those. And those are just
okay, got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, like, to kind of like, is this person former military? Is this person a parent? Does this person have friends who are parents? Does this person listen to country music or rock music? Do they have friends who listen to either of these? And so it'll start to make predictions based on who you're interacting with. So, like, I guess another example would be if you are the caretaker in your home and responsible for financial transactions, and your partner has a cousin who found out they're pregnant and is having a baby, you will likely be targeted to make the purchase of a card or a gift for that person on behalf of your partner, right? To buy that thing, right? So then you start to get into like, okay, well, again, if this is true, what else is true? If you like this, you might like this. And that's when you start to get into news media using ad tech. Instead of saying buy this product, they're saying look at this story. And the way influence works, I mean, we're more likely to agree with or like something that someone in our direct network has already liked, agreed with, or interacted with, right? So then they'll maybe push a news story to a close friend or a relative that you interact with a lot, and that person will like it and share the story, and therefore you will be more likely to pay attention to it. There's a great clip from a movie called The Great Hack, for the Trinidad and Tobago clip, really breaks down like how a cohort was specifically populated to push information to the top of an algorithm, have it populate in a very specific way to change the outcome of an election. And that is all through that same data targeting as an advertiser would use, only now it's media or it's political or it's marketing. We're also more likely to, so like, our brains work in sevens, like, you know, there's like seven deadly sins, seven dwarves. Blah, blah, blah. It's not numerology. It's actually, we have five to seven processors in our brain responsible for short-term processing. So if we see something between five and seven times, even without realizing it, we'll become familiar with that idea. So an example of this would be like the 877 cars for kids commercial, right? Like nobody sat and memorized that commercial, but we all know it. We recognize it because we've heard it so many times. It's the same metric that goes into any commercial that you see. Oftentimes, the name of the brand will be said seven times. There will be seven scenes. There will be like a seven of something. And that is a metric used in marketing. But if you're pushing out a story, a political campaign, it's not going to be just, oh, this Facebook story or oh, this TikTok story. It's going to be, how many platforms can we push this across with what targeted cohort to get them to interact so that people will respond, so that other people will respond because they trust the people who are responding.
So how does that look like? How does, say you have, I don't know, some random piece of content. How are you targeting that prime cohort that everyone else will be influenced by to make it viral?
Well, I mean, it depends on like how you're doing it, right? There's like a...
Let's go for two examples. Let's go for like a innocuous, someone self-promoting herself, and then let's go for like a misinformation example.
Sure. Okay. So say you are self-promoting a web series, if you're an actor, and you want to push it out, right? And one way you can do this is obviously targeting. You go on the back end of Google Ads or Facebook and you target like a specific audience. Like, I think that this specific piece would reach men and women between 18 and 35 who live in Southern California, identify as Democratic, make an income of $120,000 a year and blah, 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 right? So you'll start to target that and you'll start to go to media outlets and interact with them. You can do a press release. You can call in favors from press. You can start pushing out stories. The idea is to get websites with authority to start to speak about what you're doing and publish it, because then that gets seen by others because there's web ranking systems. Now you're messing with like the SEO of what you're pushing out. And then you start to get people also, like not just websites with authority, but people with high authority to talk about. So if you can get a celebrity shout out or a couple celebrity shout outs, hence influencer marketing, when it's real and not bought, you know, when people start to share that, then it starts to build momentum. And once it starts to build momentum within that cohort, then it starts to expand beyond that cohort. And once it starts to expand beyond that cohort, it starts to make it to mainstream sources. And so the same could be said for misinformation, disinformation, as you know, someone promoting something on BuzzFeed, right? I worked on a project in grad school during COVID, and it was a misinformation campaign. It was identifying a misinformation campaign about the vaccine and understanding where it was coming from. And when you dug into the roots of it, the story is actually one that had been recycled many, 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 many times over a lot of news sources overseas and shared a lot. And essentially what this group did was created a backlink wheel of third-party news sources to repost this blog over and over again to build authority in the algorithm, to then push it to secondary media sources, and then have influencers start talking about it, which then seeded it in mainstream news sources. And now you have mainstream sources talking about vaccine disinformation because they've gotten a tip and they have to make their numbers, and it has high ranking already. I mean, this blog is everywhere, so of course it must be true, right? So it's messing with the analytics. It's messing with the search engine. It's messing with authority in the search engine. Same way that somebody would market a story that isn't disinformation is how disinformation stories are being marketed, which is why it's so hard to tell the difference between the two, right? Because how do you tell the difference between someone who's, I don't know, writing for The Onion or pushing out like a story that, you know, is supposed to be fun and entertaining versus someone who's really weaponizing the media environment? But it does come down to like understanding that back end digital marketing. How are you propagating the story for virality, and how are you making this catch on so that other people start posting and talking about it? Because the more people talk about something, the higher it'll go up in the algorithm. Another example is trolls work in threes, right? So if you like have a news, if you're following a news source on Twitter or Facebook or anything else, or it has open comments and you see people having like incendiary discussion on it, it's likely engineered, right? The more people who interact, the more the algorithm will push it to the top because it looks like it's a relevant conversation to be had. And therefore you're now gaming it to push stories to the top that may or may not be legitimate, with disagreements happening on the platform in the comment section that may or may not be engineered. So sorry, long-winded answer.
No, you're good. You're good. I guess like, I kind of wanted to hone in on this interplay between SEO and the algorithm. So if I Let me just kind of replay it back to you. So I think I understand it at a high level. Is essentially any actor trying to publicize something, you start with trying to backlink to places with authority. So therefore you have authority. And then based on that authority, you're going to a micro-targeted niche within an influencer niche, I guess, like micro-influencers. And then from there, it goes to the general public. Do I have that somewhat correct?
Yes, at a high level, yes. Yeah, I mean, so there's more to it, and there's no like single order of operations to like create virality, right? But there is a technical component of exactly that. Where is the authority coming from to propagate this information?
But you need to make a video go viral.
Well, you need to kind of create the perfect storm, right? You need to have authority on a piece. You need to have people who's...
So let's what does authority mean in this case?
So now the algorithms are really getting good at like bot detection, for example, right? Like you can't just be like some nobody who created a bot account to go like something for it to propagate. Like you have to have a person with a history of being in a digital environment. So that's the first thing, right? Like we get a lot of, there's a lot of talk about like, oh, it's so easy to create fake accounts. And yeah, it is. But the way that the algorithms are measuring authority are through like your data history, your movement history, what you're doing, how engaged you are. So if you want to create the perfect storm for something to go viral, you need to get the right people with the right authority in the right niche within the right network, right? So people are, there's ranking signals in the social algorithm. So how is this person ranked within their niche cohort? Because that will determine if your story is going to go to the top or be seen. So if you are pushing something out and you have a bunch of buddies that have authority within a niche, and then on top of that, it's linking back from high authority websites. And on top of that, it's being spoken to about on multiple media platforms, not just one, but cross network. And maybe you're on a podcast, or maybe you're doing the rounds to push this out. That's how you start to create it. And obviously it can be accidentally created, but the goal is to create a perfect storm of people and ranking to make something go viral. Because once you get people interacting with it, the more people of any kind of ranking that interact with something, the more people will see it within that network. So like if you were to like something on my LinkedIn, for example, and
our choice of platform.
Yeah, our choice of platform. Yeah. Or Facebook. I don't know. I don't go on Facebook anymore. I still have one though.
Well, who does? But anyways, my mom sent me a short the other day and I was just like, I have to re-download Facebook to watch this.
Oh my God. My mom thinks that her newsfeed is people sending her personal messages. It's really adorable. Like, oh, did you see what so-and-so sent me? And I'll be like, no. She's like, oh yeah, she's celebrating her daughter's graduation. I'm so glad she kept me in the loop. I'm like, oh, I think that's her newsfeed, mom. I don't think she's sending you that personally. But exactly that, right? If someone is sharing something, and you are close to them, or you respect them, or you're in proximity, or have a history with them, and you interact with that, then that creates the cycle. Then someone who follows you and respects you, or wants to know what you're up to, is going to look at what you're commenting on, and maybe they'll comment and interact with it. And then someone who looks up to them or wants to know what they're up to, right? And so that's kind of how you create that cycle. But it does require the perfect storm of like the right rankings, the right platforms, and the right interactions.
Yeah, I guess like the content has to be viral worthy content too, though. Because I can't,
you can't just like push something out and be like, buy this t-shirt and it say something stupid and expect it to go viral. Like there is an art to it. But at the same time, it can be engineered if you have the right story producers and if you have the right data to figure out what the story needs to say to target the people that you're trying to get the story in front of.
If we're in this environment where things can be engineered to go viral, how are we looking at the other side, which is the non-content moderation side, to make it harder for the economy of bad actors to, well, work?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a catch-22, right? We live in a society where the ad tech platforms are, we live in a capitalist society where the platforms are designed to make money. It is pay to play, right? So they make their money through these algorithms. And we can't necessarily, we can't at all impede on people's freedom of speech and say, like, who's to say this story's good and this story's bad, unless it's like blatantly violent, like terrorism happening online. But even, what is that line? And in my opinion, and back to the beginning of this conversation, you know, if we're moderating content and fact-checking people, it becomes a game of whack-a-mole. There's always going to be content. There's always going to be stuff pushed out that people don't like and disagree with. It's the environment we live in. It's the media environment, freedom of press, right? Like we are free to tell stories, share information, and receive information. The challenge isn't necessarily, I mean, it is that, right? But you can't moderate that. In 2016, the ad tech platforms changed the algorithms to give people within specific niches more of a voice within a cohort, right? So now instead of seeing everything, they were seeing what the algorithm thought they wanted to see based on the data that was collected. So I've heard of, and I'm just going to preface this by saying I don't have the answer to this. It is a catch-22 paradox, but understanding what data is being collected, how it's being used by the platforms, and maybe coming up with solutions on that, like instead of the algorithm siloing an echo chamber of people within an environment because it thinks you only want to see this, maybe broadening that, maybe making it a little harder to collect data on children under the age of 18, maybe not using, I mean, why do you need my sensor data? Why do you need my contacts in my phone to tell me to tell, you know, my partner to buy a card for it? Like, you know, like that's a little invasive. It doesn't have to go so far and you can still have the same impact in, I mean, advertising has been around for generations, right? There's no shortage of the marketing community. I just think, I'm not suggesting go back to an archaic way of marketing, but kind of rolling it back to a less invasive way in marketing. Like, you know, you don't need to know that I'm going to a gas station right now so that you can target a Shell credit card to me, right? Like, so I think that there could be definitely parameters in that realm.
So if you're good. So if you woke up and you were in charge of TikTok's policy, how do you change that? What is like the first thing that you're doing to make it less invasive?
Well, so the issue with TikTok, I know that this has been like a big hot topic in national security, for example. Again, it's not the stories, it's the permissions that TikTok has to access every other piece of your phone. When you sign that privacy agreement, when you sign up for the application, you give it access to your contacts, to your location, to your private messages, to what you're doing in your other applications, right? And there's just no need for that. Now, of course, it's a social network and it wants you to connect with, you know, your peers, right? So that's why maybe it might want your contacts, but it should be something that maybe you choose to follow the people that you want, give people a little bit more autonomy instead of just populating everything for us. The issue with TikTok and national security, for example, is if you're like a military personnel and you or someone in your direct network has TikTok on your phone, it's now tracing where you are and what you're doing and who you're in contact with. And that's not to say the other tech platforms aren't doing it, because they absolutely are. And, you know, there are some geopolitical issues there. But my first, if I had my way and could moderate this without harm to anybody and not get totally booed by the platform, I would change the kind of data that's collected, the kind of tracking that happens to propagate the stories.
So how does that change the misinformation, the propagation? How does the lessening of the amount of data collected, or more ethical data collections, if that exists, but more ethical data collections, how does that lead to less propagation of misinformation?
Right. So again, we're never going to get rid of misinformation. There's always going to be misinformation. There's always going to be bad stories. There's always going to be news story edits in journalism like that historically. But in my perspective, it wouldn't block you from seeing misinformation, but it would broaden the scope of the information that you see so that you can then compare a little bit better.
Oh, so you're not getting siloed as much?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And is there concrete evidence behind this? Or have you seen it happen at least?
If you go back in time to like pre-2016, when the algorithms all changed, right? I mean, Facebook, Google, all these platforms were still making a lot of money. Advertising was still happening. Media was still huge. It just wasn't so surveillance-y. You know, people are still going to buy products. I don't know. I mean, I feel like people used to have a lot more fun with advertisements and buying things before it became down to like behavioral psychology and like what move you're going to make next to determine what you're going to buy three purchases from now. I mean, I think.
What does that mean? What do you mean people had more fun? Like, how is advertising different back then than it was now?
Like back then you had to be a little bit more creative and a little bit more quirky about how you were getting people's attention because you had to reach a broader audience. Now, all you have to do is say the thing that the data says this person is going to respond to, and only that niche will respond. Again, take this with a grain of salt. But, you know, and again, like I'm not saying that we go backwards in technology, but I am saying like, I don't know, ads could be way more creative. You have to maybe work a little harder to tell the story to get in front of the people that you want to buy your product and make it more inclusive rather than this specific cohort who did this thing in this specific area this time. Right. And it's historically worked. I mean, like there's never been a shortage of people purchasing products due to the advertisements that they consume. Now I think it's just dangerously over-targeted and hyper propagated for very specific buying purposes. And I just don't think that's fair.
Yeah, that makes sense. That honestly, you've just changed my perspective on how to look at these economies. I think it kind of reminds me of, this is a tangent, but there was this one podcast, my one that I recommend the most to other people. It's by this one professor named Mushtaq Khan. Basically, the way that he lays out his framework is from developed to less developed is how complex are the organizations in these developing nations. And the way that he like lays out this rent-seeking behavior or corruption, whatever you want to call it, is essentially you're throwing money at these people that don't have the organizational complexities to solve the problem. So they're going to inherently rent-seek. And the people, and rent-seeking in this case would, in my opinion, you're like a top-down authority and you're trying to strike whack-a-mole. His argument is you should empower the people. So this is where the analogy kind of falls off, is you should empower the people. And or maybe it doesn't fall off. Maybe you should empower the users and empower the people to, since they're the ones in power, to kind of compete with each other so that they're holding each other in checks. So maybe you want to build such a media ecosystem such that other information pieces are keeping everyone in check instead of just whack-a-mole while incentivizing more and more misleading content.
Agreed. I mean, I had a conversation earlier today about like having, and it was a hypothetical, like what could we do, third party people who don't have a hand in government or the tech companies to kind of like act as intermediaries. But then again, doing that, it's still hard to say, well, this person has allegiance to this, or this person views this like this, right? So, I mean, I don't know. I agree with you. It's such a catch-22 of an issue.
So if you're in Congress, what do you say to them?
So I actually think that people conflate like the government as a whole to like with different parts of government that are doing very different things, right? So policymakers, lobbyists, who we see on TV, those kinds of discussions are more public facing. They're not necessarily in like the defense community or dealing with, you know, some of the other issues that other parts of government are working with. So there are points where I think it's like unfair to say the government as a whole doesn't know what they're doing. Now, that said, you know, I think the people who are in positions to make decisions don't know what they're doing because they are not read up on latest trends. They don't understand the algorithm. They don't understand the ecosystem. And they're treating it almost as a like, these darn kids and their tickety talk. Like, you know, they see these stories, they see the outcome. They're seeing shootings happening at schools. They're seeing acts of terror. They're seeing all these things happen offline. And they get the buzzwords. Oh, it's disinformation. Oh, it's the story. Oh, it's these social platforms. But they're not seeing the ecosystem. They have no idea how the media landscape works, how algorithms work, what goes on behind the scenes to get those stories to propagate. And so what I would say to Congress is like, I don't know, put people in positions of power who actually understand what's going on so that they can make policies that A, don't impede on human rights, B, don't surveillance citizens, and C, can actually like help us progress a little bit rather than, you know, it feels a little bit like on, and this is not party specific, on both sides of the spectrum, it feels a little bit like a witch hunt because nobody knows how the ecosystem works. It's bad. Disinformation. Yes, disinformation is bad. But you can't just tell people they can't consume stories. You can't just say the story is bad. There has to be another way. And in my opinion, it is having them understand what the ecosystem, what the infrastructure of that story propagation really looks like, and putting more policies and having more discussions around data collection and ad tech.
So what is that? What is an example of this, of these policies look like?
Data collection on children under the age of 18 being used for commercial purposes.
Sounds like a good policy.
Yeah. Like, you know, don't do it. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there has to be some data collected, but like there should be like safeguards on like, we should not be collecting like signals on children who are playing games on their iPad, you know, to market products to them in a way. Right. I mean, they're going to see advertisements regardless. If they're watching something on YouTube, they'll see an advertisement. Does it have to be that targeted? Do you really need to know like the income of this child's family to like, you know, and their religion? So, like, I mean, it's a lot. So that is one thing. Age limits on surveillance tech.
So yeah. I guess like another one would be, is you just want it to be transparent, right? Like what features are you using to where, what are your data sources? I guess like even that transparency would go a long way. Every platform or data broker said, these are the different places we're getting our data from. And this is the different features that we have. It would just shine a light as to what they're using to target you.
Well, they do. I mean, in their privacy agreement, but do you have time to read a 120 page like policy when you download a new application to your phone?
And changing terms of service. That's one of my rants, is like no one ever reads terms of service. So don't even try to, like, just getting someone to agree to it is almost an act of coercion. But yeah.
So technically they do. Technically in that privacy agreement, they do outline everywhere they're getting your data from. But nobody's reading every policy agreement that they sign. And, you know, the algorithms update so frequently. Even in the last couple of weeks, I've noticed. I'm doing a research project for work. And
what's the research project?
It has to do with like data collected through cell phones, your telemetrics, right? So it used to be that like you could use a Google Voice number to validate applications. Now it needs like a hard cell phone number. So that tells me that data is being collected and validated through your cell phone signal more than it is your IP address. Which, I mean, you'll have like your IMEI on your phone or your SIM card versus like working in an environment, because that's a better way to validate the bot issue. But at the same time, now it gets even more data on who you are, what you're doing, who you're in contact with, to validate that you're not a bot, to be able to push different information, right? So the algorithm just changes so frequently. But I think knowing what's knowable about you is key. Maybe it's not going to come from each of us reading all of our privacy agreements, because nobody's going to, but education on how the ecosystem works, knowing what you are giving off, knowing what your footprint looks like, and understanding that you are seeing certain content because of that pattern. So yeah. Education is definitely going to be a huge part of it.
Actually, I don't know. Like, education is definitely a big part. I'm not saying that, but a part of me is saying that education of the algorithm is almost like education of the economy, in the sense that you can get these basic frameworks down of like supply and demand. Like, this is the supply of different niches. This is demand on different niches. This is how the algorithm will get going. This is how you have psychological tricks, et cetera, et cetera. But fundamentally, these platforms are so over-engineered and complex, and this not complex in the sense that they're ununderstandable, but complex in the sense that they have like thousands, if not millions, of different data inputs and millions of different data outputs. Yeah. If you just look at the graph of, like, if you look at one data row, how does that go into one ML algorithm? And then that algorithm changes, or that feature changes to another feature, and then and then something else changes to another feature. So then you get this, if you just graph this all out, I'm sure it's like,
that's so much.
The billions of nodes, if not more, trillions, and so much more than that. And how do you distill that graph into a cogent narrative and like, oh, this is our supply graph. This is our demand graph. You know,
I think
this
going is... to like, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go for it.
I think going to the basics, right? Like, I mean, while there are thousands of ranking signals, there's like four that'll never change. So let's focus on those, right? Like, what are the baselines of these? And then you can use your imagination to like zoom out and see that it is a bigger infrastructure economy. I think education on like the basic inner workings of the information economy, having a basic understanding of like cybersecurity measures and how they work. I mean, you don't have to be, I have a master's degree in cybercrime and I'm not a technical cyber person. Now, mind you, I'm like really, really great at like OSINT and can find literally anything, but I'm not a coder. My Python is crap and I can still discuss and understand how these ecosystems work without being the one to be like the hacker, right? The one to like go into it. So you don't have to be a technical person to understand the media environment. We're all using technology every day. We're all informed on what we're playing with. I think having a broader picture of how it's all interconnected would be extremely beneficial to a lot of people in society.
So what does that concretely look like? Like, what does this education look like? Does this education look like LinkedIn content? Does this education look like a class? Actually, there was a good reel that I know this is a kick, not too much of a tangent, but I saw that TikTok is also making a new tab for science and education content. So that's one part of it. And then another thing that I saw, which was a very interesting experiment, was I think it's called Quiver Finance. Is it someone on TikTok that would be like, oh, invest in this, this, and this, because this is what Congress people are investing in. Just basically exposing how the money and then like Congress is like forecasting what like good returns. So that was an interesting way that I saw TikTok being used to, I guess like they pivoted into a profitable way. Like, this is how you should make money, but it's also like, this is a good illumination of corruption. I guess my question for you then is, do you see something like that similarly for understanding media environments?
I mean, right now I teach a class. Part of it is cognitive security and part of it is
cognitive security,
data security. Yeah. Like it's the, like how like the human triggers in like gamified applications kind of thing. That is a different podcast.
Trying to ask for it.
Yeah. Nope. So there's that kind of like mixed with like a data defense class. Again, that's understanding what's knowable about you, which is a course that I do, but right now it's only for at like universities and for private organizations. I think it might be a good idea to like, as kids are learning to code in school today, like, I mean, which they are, right? Teaching them about the environment that they're coding in, I think would be extremely helpful. Like, hey, you're coding this and this is what's happening here. This is how it interacts with everything else. And starting it young so that they know, oh, I'm not just putting numbers into a computer for a singular siloed thing. I'm learning how to code. I'm doing this work and it's going to impact the whole ecosystem. So yeah, I mean, it's important to have tech education in early childhood. I certainly did, but my parents had to like send me to a private like class on computers. This was like back in the early, in the 90s. But you know, I think it should be available to everyone. I think not just media literacy, but tech literacy, data literacy, understanding the interconnectedness of all of it. There's a lot of media literacy programs that exist now, but it's not just about media literacy. It's about how that media is propagated. So information literacy, starting at a younger age, as they begin to learn and play with and break and build and get to know the tech ecosystem in which they're working.
What's the difference between data literacy and tech literacy?
So I don't think there's a difference, but people argue with me about it all the time. So, I mean, I look at all of this as like an information security, cybersecurity issue. People look at tech security, like they think of Mr. Robot and like hacking and like ransomware, and they think of information security as like your data and stories. The reality is behind everyone, and one of my favorite TED Talks by Laura Gallant, says at the end of every one and zero is a person and a story and a person responding to a story. So it doesn't matter if you're being hacked or if you were being propagated or if you're being targeted with a story, you are a human responding offline. The end game is your data so that you can get you to respond offline. If somebody is hacking your computer, they're hacking into your computer to gain access to information, data. If somebody is pushing out a story using your data, it's to get you to do something that you normally wouldn't otherwise do, right? So they're different sides of the same coin, but they do work together. And I think a lot of people miss that. There's a gap in understanding that this is a bigger ecosystem. It's not just about, oh, I need to save my computer from being hacked. Oh, they're going to get my data. Well, yeah, but what do you think they're going to do with that data? Like, why do you think data is so important? Well, I don't know. They have my address. Okay. So are they going to target you? Are they going to show up at your house? So what is that data being used for? Is it access to business information? Is it access to classified information? I mean, what is the computer in question being hacked for? And that is to gain access to data to do something with it. That something can be any number of things, but it does come down to a human response to whatever is done in that scenario. So tech literacy, information literacy, media literacy, I think they all kind of, we need to start looking at them a little bit more cohesively as a joint hybrid information environment strategy. I know that's not a word, but yeah, I think we tend to silo the subject, right? Policymakers have one view of it. Tech professionals have another view of it. Cybersecurity professionals have another view of it. And the reality is it's all the same environment, and all of these different sides need to be talking and working together to come up with better solutions rather than saying, well, my solution for this is this, and it has nothing to do with that. Cause that's not true. Sorry, a little rambly again, but I, if you look at like adversarial powers, you know, they don't have separate words necessarily for cybersecurity and information security and data security. It is all one information environment, and everything they do is within that environment. Here in the United States, we're very obsessed with compartmentalizing the different components of the digital domain. And we can't look at it as this separate entity that only like certain coding people can deal with and interact with, because we all interact with it every day, right? This is not a siloed separate thing. It's involved. Digital environment is in everything we do. It is augmenting everything. So to say that it's a separate thing and you have to have separate standards when it's touching everything else that we've always historically done, I think is the wrong approach to coming up with solutions. So back to your question, media, well, the question was, I'm sorry, tech literacy versus information literacy. You know, if I had my choice, and again, grain of salt, you know, I'm learning as I go too. I changed all the time, but I think it needs to be general literacy of the information environment and how it impacts everything else. It's all connected, literally and figuratively.
Thank you so much. I never put these two things together, or at least like, I like what you said about the ones and zeros. Behind every one zero, there's like a story, there's a person behind it. It both gives me hope, and it's a little scary, but it's also like hopeful, because it's still like, no matter how abstract everything becomes or how AI dependent everything becomes, it's still a human story. So that's nice to know and hear. I mean, obviously the scary part is it's still a human story. So human vices come with it, and the ability to, and human psychological hacks come with that too. But those always existed. So I appreciate your time and coming on the podcast.
I'm so excited to start interviewing others in the space and continuing the conversation and being a part of this podcast.
Thank you for coming on the show. And yeah, looking forward to having you here for a while now.
Thank you. I'm excited.
If you enjoyed today's conversation, please share this episode to your friends so we can continue making episodes like this. Today's episode was produced by me, Talha Baig. Music by Zhao Shen. And special thanks to Sahar, Cass, Rachel, and Sean for their continued support.